if it was tradition to always ask that question. "You don't need to bring anything," I answered. "I'll pick you up at 4:45. We stood there for a moment without saying anything else, and I could tell Hagbert was growing a little impatient. He hadn't turned a page of the book since we'd been standing there. "I'll see you tomorrow," she said finally. "Okay," I said. She glanced down at her feet for a moment, then back up at me. "Thank you for driving me home," she said. With that, she turned around and walked inside. I could barely see the slight smile playing gently across her lips as she peeked around the door, just as it was about to close. The next day, I picked her up right on schedule and was pleased to see that her hair was down once more. She was wearing the sweater I'd given her, just like she'd promised. Both my mom and dad were a little surprised when I'd asked if it would be all right if Jamie came by for dinner. It wasn't a big deal. Whenever my dad was around, my mom would have Helen, our cook, make enough food for a small army. I guess I didn't mention that earlier. About the cook, I mean. In our house, we had a maid and a cook, not only because my family could afford them, but also because my mom wasn't the greatest homemaker in the world. She was all right at making sandwiches for my lunch now and then, but there had been times when the mustard would stain her nails, and it would take her at least 3 or 4 days to get over it. Without Helen, I would have grown up eating burned mashed potatoes and crunchy steak. My father, luckily, had realized this as soon as they married, and both the cook and the maid had been with us since before I was born. Though our house was larger than most, it wasn't a palace or anything, and neither the cook nor the maid lived with us because we didn't have separate living quarters or anything like that. My father had bought the home because of its historical value. Though it wasn't the house where Blackbeard had once lived, which would have been more interesting to someone like me, it had been owned by Richard Dobbs Spate, who'd signed the Constitution. Spate had also owned a farm outside of Newbern, which was about 40 miles up the road, and that was where he was buried. Our house might not have been as famous as the one where Dobbs Spate was buried, but it still afforded my father some bragging rights in the halls of Congress, and whenever he walked around the garden, I could see him dreaming about the legacy he wanted to leave. In a way, it made me sad, because no matter what he did, he'd never top old Richard Dobbs Spate. Historical events like signing the Constitution come along only once every few hundred years, and no matter how you sliced it, debating farm subsidies for tobacco farmers or talking about the red influence was never going to cut it. Even someone like me knew that. The house was in the National Historic Registry, still is, I suppose, and though Jamie had been there once before, she was still kind of awed when she walked inside. My mother and father were both dressed very nicely, as was I, and my mother kissed Jamie hello on the cheek. My mother, I couldn't help but think as I watched her do it, had scored before I did. We had a nice dinner, fairly formal, with 4 courses, though it wasn't stuffy or anything like that. My parents and Jamie carried on the most marvelous conversation, think Miss Garber here, and though I tried to inject my own brand of humor, it didn't really go over too well, at least as far as my parents were concerned. Jamie, however, would laugh, and I took that as a good sign. After dinner, I invited Jamie to walk around the garden, even though it was winter and nothing was in bloom. After putting on our coats, we stepped outside into the chilled winter air. I could see our breaths coming out in little puffs. "Your parents are wonderful people," she said to me. I guess she hadn't taken Hagbert's sermons to heart. "They're nice," I responded, "in their own way. My mom's especially sweet." I said this not only because it was true, but also because it was the same thing that kids said about Jamie. I hoped she would get the hint. She stopped to look at the rose bushes. They looked like gnarled sticks, and I didn't see what her interest was in them. "Is it true about your grandfather?" she asked me, "the stories that people tell?" I guess she didn't get my hint. "Yes," I said, trying not to show my disappointment. "That's sad," she said simply. "There's more to life than money." "I know." She looked at me.
"Do you?"
I didn't meet her eyes as I answered. Don't ask me why. "I know that what my grandfather did was wrong.
But you don't want to give it back, do you?"
"I've never really thought about it, to tell you the truth."
Would you, though?
I didn't answer right away, and Jamie turned from me. She was staring at the rose bushes with their gnarled sticks again, and I suddenly realized that she'd wanted me to say yes. It's what she would have done without thinking twice about it. "Why do you do things like that?" I blurted out before I could stop myself, blood rushing into my cheeks. "Making me feel guilty, I mean. I wasn't the one who did it. I just happened to be born into this family." She reached out and touched a branch.
"That doesn't mean you can't undo it," she said gently, "when you get the opportunity."
Her point was clear, even to me, and deep down I knew she was right. But that decision, if it ever came, was a long way off. To my way of thinking, I had more important things on my mind. I changed the subject back to something I could relate to better.
"Does your father like me?" I asked. I wanted to know if Hegbert would allow me to see her again.
It took a moment for her to answer.
"My father," she said slowly, "worries about me."
"Don't all parents?" I asked. She looked at her feet, then off to the side again, before turning back to me.
"I think that with him it's different from most. But my father does like you, and he knows that it makes me happy to see you. That's why he let me come over to your house for dinner tonight."
"I'm glad he did," I said, meaning it.
"So am I."
We looked at each other under the light of a waxing crescent moon, and I almost kissed her right then. But she turned away a moment too soon and said something that sort of threw me.
"My father worries about you too, Landon."
The way she said it, it was soft and sad at the same time, let me know that it wasn't simply because he thought I was irresponsible, or that I used to hide behind the trees and call him names, or even that I was a member of the Carter family.
"Why?" I asked. "For the same reason that I do," she said.
She didn't elaborate any further, and I knew right then that she was holding something back, something that she couldn't tell me, something that made her sad as well. But it wasn't until later that I learned her secret. Being in love with a girl like Jamie Sullivan was without a doubt the strangest thing I'd ever been through. Not only was she a girl that I'd never thought about before this year, even though we'd grown up together, but there was something different in the whole way my feelings for her had unfolded. This wasn't like being with Angela, whom I'd kissed the first time I was ever alone with her. I still hadn't kissed Jamie. I hadn't even hugged her, or taken her to Cecil's Diner, or even to a movie. I hadn't done any of the things that I normally did with girls, yet somehow I'd fallen in love. The problem was, I still didn't know how she felt about me. Oh, sure, there were some indications, and I hadn't missed them. The Bible was, of course, the biggie, but there was also the way she'd looked at me when she'd closed the door on Christmas Eve, and she'd let me hold her hand on the ride home from the orphanage. To my way of thinking, there was definitely something there. I just wasn't exactly sure of how to take the next step. When I'd finally taken her home after Christmas dinner, I'd asked if it would be okay if I came by from time to time, and she'd said it would be fine. That's exactly how she said it, too. "That would be fine." I didn't take the lack of enthusiasm personally. Jamie had a tendency to talk like an adult, and I think that's why she got along with older people so well. The following day, I walked to her house, and the first thing I noticed was that Hegbert's car wasn't in the driveway. When she answered the door, I knew enough not to ask her if I could come in.
"Hello, Landon,"
she said, as she always did, as if it were a surprise to see me. Again, her hair was down, and I took this as a positive sign.
"Hey, Jamie,"
I said casually. She motioned to the chairs.
"My father's not home, but we can sit on the porch if you'd like."
Don't even ask me how it happened, because I still can't explain it. One second I was standing there in front of her expecting to walk to the side of the porch, and in the next second I wasn't. Instead of moving toward the chairs, I took a step closer to her and found myself reaching for her hand. I took it in mine and looked right at her, moving just a little closer. She didn't exactly step back, but her eyes widened just a little, and for a tiny, flickering moment I thought I'd done the wrong thing and debated going any further. I paused and smiled, sort of tilting my head to the side. And the next thing I saw was that she'd closed her eyes and was tilting her head, too, and that our faces were moving closer together. It wasn't that long, and it certainly wasn't the kind of kiss you see in movies these days, but it was wonderful in its own way. And all I can remember about the moment is that when our lips first touched, I knew the memory would last forever. Chapter 11. "You're the first boy I've ever kissed," she said to me. It was a few days before the new year, and Jamie and I were standing at the iron steamer pier in Pine Knoll Shores. To get there, we'd had to cross the bridge that spans the intercoastal waterway and drive a little way down the island. Nowadays, the place has some of the most expensive beachfront property in the entire state, but back then it was mainly sand dunes nestled against the Maritime National Forest. "I figured I might have been," I said. "Why?" she asked innocently. "Did I do it wrong?" She didn't look like she'd be too upset if I said yes, but it wouldn't have been the truth. "You're a great kisser," I said, giving her hand a squeeze. She nodded and turned toward the ocean, her eyes getting that far-off look again. She'd been doing that a lot lately. I let it go on for a while before the silence sort of got to me. "Are you okay, Jamie?" I finally asked. Instead of answering, she changed the subject. "Have you ever been in love?" she asked me. I ran my hand through my hair and gave her one of those looks. "You mean before now?" I said it like James Dean would have, the way Eric had told me to say it if a girl ever asked me that question. Eric was pretty slick with girls. "I'm serious, Landon," she said, tossing me a sidelong glance. I guess Jamie had seen those movies, too. With Jamie, I'd come to realize, I always seem to be going from high to low and back to high again in less time than it takes to swat a mosquito. I wasn't quite sure if I liked that part of our relationship yet, though to be honest, it kept me on my toes. I was still feeling off balance as I thought about her question. "Actually, I have," I said finally. Her eyes were still fixed on the ocean. I think she thought I was talking about Angela, but looking back, I'd realized that what I'd felt for Angela was totally different from what I was feeling right now. "How did you know it was love?" she asked me. I watched the breeze gently moving her hair, and I knew that it was no time to pretend I was something that I actually wasn't. "Well," I said seriously, "you know it's love when all you want to do is spend time with the other person, and you sort of know that the other person feels the same way." Jamie thought about my answer before smiling faintly. "I see," she said softly. I waited for her to add something else, but she didn't, and I came to another sudden realization. Jamie may not have been all that experienced with boys, but to tell you the truth, she was playing me like a harp. During the next 2 days, for instance, she wore her hair in a bun again. On New Year's Eve, I took Jamie out to dinner. It was the very first real date she'd ever been on, and we went to a small waterfront restaurant in Moorhead City, a place called Flavin's. Flavin's was a kind of restaurant with tablecloths and candles and 5 different pieces of silverware per setting. The waiters wore black and white like butlers, and when you looked out the giant windows that completely lined the wall, you could watch moonlight reflecting off the slowly moving water. There was a pianist and a singer, too, not every night or even every weekend, but on holidays when they thought the place would be full. I had to make reservations, and the first time I called, they said they were filled. But I had my mom call him, and the next thing you knew, something had opened up. I guess the owner needed a favor from my father or something. Or maybe he just didn't want to make him angry, knowing that my grandfather was still alive and all. It was actually my mom's idea to take Jamie out someplace special. A couple of days before, on one of those days Jamie was wearing her hair in a bun, I talked to my mom about the things I was going through. "She's all I think about, Mom," I confessed.
I mean, I know she likes me, but I don't know if she feels the same way that I do.
Does she mean that much to you? She asked.
Yes, I said quietly.
Well, what have you tried so far?
What do you mean? My mom smiled. I mean that young girls, even Jamie, like to be made to feel special.
I thought about that for a moment, a little confused. Wasn't that what I was trying to do?
Well, I've been going to her house every day to visit, I said.
My mom put her hand on my knee. Even though she wasn't a great homemaker and sometimes stuck it to me, like I said earlier, she really was a sweet lady.
Going to her house is a nice thing to do, but it's not the most romantic thing there is. You should do something that will really let her know how you feel about her.
My mom suggested buying some perfume, and although I knew that Jamie would probably be happy to receive it, it didn't sound right to me. For one thing, since Hegbert didn't allow her to wear makeup, with the single exception being the Christmas play, I was sure she couldn't wear perfume. I told my mom as much, and that was when she'd suggested taking her out to dinner.
I don't have any money left, I said to her dejectedly.
Though my family was wealthy and gave me an allowance, they never gave me more if I ran through it too quickly.
It builds responsibility, my father said, explaining it once.
What happened to your money in the bank?
I sighed, and my mom sat in silence while I explained what I had done.
When I finished, a look of quiet satisfaction crossed her face, as if she too knew I was finally growing up.
Let me worry about that, she said softly. You just find out if she'd like to go and if Reverend Sullivan will allow it. If she can, we'll find a way to make it happen. I promise.
The following day, I went to the church. I knew that Hegbert would be in his office. I hadn't asked Jamie yet because I figured she would need his permission, and for some reason, I wanted to be the one who asked. I guess it had to do with the fact that Hegbert hadn't exactly been welcoming me with open arms when I visited. Whenever he'd see me coming up the walkway, like Jamie, he had a sixth sense about it. He'd peek out the curtains, then quickly pull his head back behind them, thinking that I hadn't seen him. When I knocked, it would take a long time for him to answer the door, as if he had to come from the kitchen. He'd look at me for a long moment, then sigh deeply and shake his head, before finally saying hello. His door was partially open, and I saw him sitting behind his desk, spectacles propped on his nose. He was looking over some papers. They looked almost financial, and I figured he was trying to figure out the church budget for the following year. Even ministers had bills to pay. I knocked at the door, and he looked up with interest as if he expected another member of the congregation, then furrowed his brow when he saw that it was me.
"Hello, Reverend Sullivan," I said politely. "Do you have a moment?"
He looked even more tired than usual, and I assumed he wasn't feeling well.
"Hello, Landon," he said wearily.
I dressed sharply for the occasion, by the way, with a jacket and tie.
"May I come in?"
He nodded slightly, and I entered the office. He motioned for me to sit in the chair across from his desk.
"What can I do for you?" he asked.
I adjusted myself nervously in the chair.
"Well, sir, I wanted to ask you something."
He stared at me, studying me, before he finally spoke.
"Does it have to do with Jamie?" he asked.
I took a deep breath.
"Yes, sir. I wanted to ask if it would be all right with you if I took her to dinner on New Year's Eve."
He sighed.
"Is that all?" he said.
"Yes, sir," I said.
"I'll bring her home any time you'd need me to."
He took off his spectacles and wiped them with his handkerchief before putting them back on. I could tell he was taking a moment to think about it.
"Will your parents be joining you?" he asked.
"No, sir."
"Then I don't think that will be possible. But thank you for asking my permission first."
He looked down at the papers, making it clear it was time for me to leave. I stood from my chair and started toward the door. As I was about to go, I faced him again.
"Reverend Sullivan?"
He looked up, surprised I was still there.
"I'm sorry for those things I used to do when I was younger. and I'm sorry that I didn't always treat Jamie the way she should have been treated. But from now on, things will change. I promise you that.
He seemed to look right through me. It wasn't enough.
I love her, I said finally. And when I said it, his attention focused on me again.
I know you do, he answered sadly. But I don't want to see her hurt.
Even though I must have been imagining it, I thought I saw his eyes begin to water.
I wouldn't do that to her, I said. He turned from me and looked out the window, watching as the winter sun tried to force its way through the clouds. It was a gray day, cold and bitter. Have her home by 10, he finally said, as though he knew he'd made the wrong decision. I smiled and wanted to thank him, though I didn't. I could tell that he wanted to be alone. When I glanced over my shoulder on my way out the door, I was puzzled to see his face in his hands. I asked Jamie an hour later. The first thing she said was that she didn't think she could go, but I told her that I'd already spoken to her father. She seemed surprised, and I think it had an effect on how she viewed me after that. The one thing I didn't tell her was that it looked almost as though Hagbert had been crying as I'd made my way out the door. Not only didn't I understand it completely, I didn't want her to worry. That night, though, after talking to my mom again, she provided me with a possible explanation. And to be honest, it made perfect sense to me. Hagbert must have come to the realization that his daughter was growing up and that he was slowly losing her to me. In a way, I hoped that was true. I picked her up right on schedule. Though I hadn't asked her to wear her hair down, she'd done it for me. Silently, we drove over the bridge, down the waterfront to the restaurant. When we got to the hostess stand, the owner himself appeared and walked us to our table. It was one of the better ones in the place. It was crowded by the time we arrived, and all around us people were enjoying themselves. On New Year's, people dressed fashionably, and we were the only two teenagers in the place. I didn't think we looked too out of place, though. Jamie had never been to Flavin's before, and it took her just a few minutes to take it all in. She seemed nervously happy, and I knew right away that my mom had made the right suggestion.
This is wonderful, she said to me. Thank you for asking me.
My pleasure, I said sincerely.
Have you been here before?
A few times. My mother and father like to come here sometimes when my father comes home from Washington. She looked out the window and stared at a boat that was passing by the restaurant, its lights blazing. For a moment she seemed lost in wonder.
It's beautiful here, she said.
So are you, I answered. Jamie blushed.
You don't mean that.
Yes, I said quietly, I do. We held hands while we waited for dinner, and Jamie and I talked about some of the things that had happened in the past few months. She laughed when we talked about the homecoming dance, and I finally admitted the reason I'd asked her in the first place. She was a good sport about it. She sort of laughed it off cheerfully, and I knew that she'd already figured it out on her own.
Would you want to take me again?
She teased.
Absolutely.
Dinner was delicious. We both ordered the sea bass and salads, and when the waiter finally removed our plates, the music started up. We had an hour left before I had to bring her home, and I offered her my hand. At first, we were the only ones on the floor, everyone watching us as we glided around the floor. I think they all knew how we were feeling about each other, and it reminded them of when they were young, too. I could see them smiling wistfully at us. The lights were dim, and when the singer began a slow melody, I held her close to me with my eyes closed, wondering if anything in my life had ever been this perfect, and knowing at the same time that it hadn't. I was in love. And the feeling was even more wonderful than I ever imagined it could be. After New Year's, we spent the next week and a half together, doing the things that young couples did back then, though from time to time she seemed tired and listless. We spent time down by the Neuse River, tossing stones in the water, watching the ripples while we talked. Or we went to the beach near Fort Macon. Even though it was winter, the ocean the color of iron, it was something that both of us enjoyed doing. After an hour or so, Jamie would ask me to take her home, and we'd hold hands in the car.
Sometimes it seemed she would almost nod off before we even got home, while other times she would keep up a stream of chatter all the way back so that I could barely get a word in edgewise. Of course, spending time with Jamie also meant doing the things she enjoyed as well. Though I wouldn't go to her Bible study class, I didn't want to look like an idiot in front of her, we did visit the orphanage twice more, and each time we went there, I felt more at home. Once, though, we'd had to leave early because she was running a slight fever. Even to my untrained eyes, it was clear that her face was flushed. We kissed again, too, though not every time we were together, and I didn't even think of trying to make it to second base. There wasn't any need to. There was something nice when I kissed her, something gentle and right, and that was enough for me. The more I did it, the more I realized that Jamie had been misunderstood her entire life, not only by me, but by everyone. Jamie wasn't simply the minister's daughter, someone who read the Bible and did her best to help others. Jamie was also a 17-year-old girl with the same hopes and doubts that I had. At least that's what I assumed, until she finally told me. I'll never forget that day because of how quiet she had been. I had the funny feeling all day long that something important was on her mind. I was walking her home from Cecil's Diner on the Saturday before school started up again, a day blustery with a fierce, biting wind. A nor'easter had been blowing in since the previous morning, and while we walked, we'd had to stand close to each other to stay warm. Jamie had her arm looped through mine, and we were walking slowly, even more slowly than usual, and I could tell she wasn't feeling well again. She hadn't really wanted to go with me because of the weather, but I'd asked her because of my friends. It was time, I remember thinking, that they finally knew about us. The only problem, as fate would have it, was that no one else was at Cecil's Diner. As with many coastal communities, things were quiet on the waterfront in the middle of winter. She was quiet as we walked, and I knew that she was thinking of a way to tell me something. I didn't expect her to start the conversation as she did. "People think I'm strange, don't they?" she finally said, breaking the silence. "Who do you mean?" I asked, even though I knew the answer. "People at school." "No, they don't," I lied. I kissed her cheek as I squeezed her arm a little tighter to me. She winced, and I could tell that I'd hurt her somehow. "Are you okay?" I asked, concerned. "I'm fine," she said, regaining her composure and keeping the subject on track. "Will you do me a favor, though?" "Anything," I said. "Will you promise to tell me the truth from now on? I mean, always." "Sure," I said. She stopped me suddenly and looked right at me. "Are you lying to me right now?" "No," I said defensively, wondering where this was going. "I promise that from now on I'll always tell you the truth." Somehow, when I said it, I knew that I'd come to regret it. We started walking again. As we moved down the street, I glanced at her hand, which was looped through mine, and I saw a large bruise just below her ring finger. I had no idea where it had come from, since it hadn't been there the day before. For a second, I thought it might have been caused by me, but then I realized that I hadn't even touched her there. "People think I'm strange, don't they?" she asked again. My breath was coming out in little puffs. "Yes," I finally answered. It hurt me to say it. "Why?" She looked almost despondent. I thought about it. "People have different reasons," I said vaguely, doing my best not to go any further. "But why, exactly? Is it because of my father, or is it because I try to be nice to people?" I didn't want anything to do with this. "I suppose," was all I could say. I felt a little queasy. Jamie seemed disheartened, and we walked a little farther in silence. "Do you think I'm strange, too?" she asked me. The way she said it made me ache more than I thought it would. We were almost at her house before I stopped her and held her close to me. I kissed her, and when we pulled apart, she looked down at the ground. I put my finger beneath her chin, lifting her head up and making her look at me again. "You're a wonderful person, Jamie. You're beautiful, you're kind, you're gentle. You're everything that I'd like to be. If people don't like you or they think you're strange, then that's their problem." In the grayish glow of a cold winter day, I could see her lower lip begin to tremble. Mine was doing the same thing, and I suddenly realized that my heart was speeding up as well. I looked in her eyes, smiling with all the feeling I could muster, knowing that I couldn't keep the words inside any longer. "I love you, Jamie," I said to her. "You're the best thing that ever happened to me." It was the first time I'd ever said the words to another person besides a member of my immediate family. When I'd imagined saying it to someone else, I'd somehow thought it would be hard. But it wasn't. I'd never been more sure of anything. As soon as I said the words, though, Jamie bowed her head and started to cry, leaning her body into mine. I wrapped my arms around her, wondering what was wrong. She was thin, and I realized for the first time that my arms went all the way around her. She'd lost weight, even in the last week and a half, and I remembered that she'd barely touched her food earlier. She kept crying into my chest for what seemed like a long time. I wasn't sure what to think, or even if she felt the same way I did. Even so, I didn't regret the words. The truth is always the truth, and I just promised her that I would never lie again.
"Please don't say that," she said to me. "Please,
but I do," I said, thinking she didn't believe me. She began to cry even harder.
"I'm sorry," she whispered to me through her ragged sobs. "I'm so, so sorry."
My throat suddenly went dry.
"Why are you sorry?"
I asked, suddenly desperate to understand what was bothering her. "Is it because of my friends and what they'll say? I don't care anymore. I really don't." I was reaching for anything, confused and, yes, scared. It took another long moment for her to stop crying, and in time she looked up at me. She kissed me gently, almost like the breath of a passerby on a city street, then ran her finger over my cheek.
"You can't be in love with me, Landon," she said through red and swollen eyes. "We can be friends, we can see each other, but you can't love me."
"Why not?" I shouted hoarsely, not understanding any of this.
"Because," she finally said softly, "I'm very sick, Landon."
The concept was so absolutely foreign that I couldn't comprehend what she was trying to say.
"So what? You'll take a few days..."
A sad smile crossed her face, and I knew right then what she was trying to tell me. Her eyes never left mine as she finally said the words that numbed my soul.
"I'm dying, Landon."
Chapter 12. She had leukemia. She'd known it since last summer. The moment she told me, the blood drained from my face, and a sheaf of dizzying images fluttered through my mind. It was as though in that brief moment time had suddenly stopped, and I understood everything that had happened between us. I understood why she'd wanted me to do the play. I understood why, after we'd performed that first night, Hegbert had whispered to her with tears in his eyes, calling her his angel. I understood why he looked so tired all the time and why he fretted that I kept coming by the house. Everything became absolutely clear. Why she wanted Christmas at the orphanage to be so special. Why she didn't think she'd go to college. Why she'd given me her Bible. It all made perfect sense. And at the same time, nothing seemed to make any sense at all. Jamie Sullivan had leukemia. Jamie, sweet Jamie, was dying.
My Jamie. "No, no," I whispered to her. "There has to be some mistake."
But there wasn't. And when she told me again, my world went blank. My head started to spin, and I clung to her tightly to keep from losing my balance. On the street, I saw a man and a woman walking towards us, heads bent and their hands on their hats to keep them from blowing away. A dog trotted across the road and stopped to smell some bushes. A neighbor across the way was standing on a stepladder taking down his Christmas lights. Normal scenes from everyday life, things I would never have noticed before, suddenly making me feel angry. I closed my eyes, wanting the whole thing to go away.
"I'm so sorry, Landon,"
she kept saying over and over. It was I who should have been saying it, however. I know that now, but my confusion kept me from saying anything. Deep down, I knew it wouldn't go away. I held her again, not knowing what else to do, tears filling my eyes, trying and failing to be the rock I think she needed. We cried together on the street for a long time, just a little way down the road from her house. We cried some more when Hegbert opened the door and saw our faces, knowing immediately that their secret was out. We cried when we told my mother later that afternoon, and my mother held us both to her bosom and sobbed so loudly that both the maid and the cook wanted to call the doctor because they thought something had happened to my father. On Sunday, Hegbert made the announcement to his congregation, his face a mask of anguish and fear, and he had to be helped back to his seat before he'd even finished. Everyone in the congregation stared in silent disbelief at the words they just heard, as if they were waiting for a punchline to some horrible joke that none of them could believe had been told. Then all at once the wailing began. We sat with Hegbert the day she told me, and Jamie patiently answered my questions. She didn't know how long she had left, she told me. No, there wasn't anything the doctors could do. It was a rare form of the disease, they'd said, one that didn't respond to available treatment. Yes, when the school year had started, she'd felt fine. It wasn't until the last few weeks that she'd started to feel its effects. That's how it progresses, she said. You feel fine, and then when your body can't keep fighting, you don't. Stifling my tears, I couldn't help but think about the play. But all those rehearsals, those long days. Maybe you shouldn't have, maybe, she said, reaching for my hand and cutting me off. Doing the play was the thing that kept me healthy for so long. Later, she told me that 7 months had passed since she'd been diagnosed. The doctors had given her a year, maybe less. These days, it might have been different. These days, they could have treated her. These days, Jamie would probably live. But this was happening 40 years ago, and I knew what that meant. Only a miracle could save her. Why didn't you tell me? This was the one question I hadn't asked her, the one that I'd been thinking about. I hadn't slept that night, and my eyes were still swollen. I'd gone from shock to denial to sadness to anger and back again all night long, wishing it weren't so and praying that the whole thing had been some terrible nightmare. We were in her living room the following day, the day that Hegbert had made the announcement to the congregation. It was January 10, 1959. Jamie didn't look as depressed as I thought she would. But then again, she'd been living with this for 7 months already. She and Hegbert had been the only ones to know, and neither of them had trusted even me. I was hurt by that and frightened at the same time. I'd made a decision, she explained to me, that it would be better if I told no one, and I asked my father to do the same. You saw how people were after the services today. No one would even look me in the eye. If you had only a few months left to live, is that what you would want? I knew she was right, but it didn't make it any easier. I was, for the first time in my life, completely and utterly at a loss. I'd never had anyone close to me die before, at least not anyone that I could remember. My grandmother had died when I was 3, and I don't remember a single thing about her, or the services that had followed, or even the next few years after her passing. I'd heard stories, of course, from both my father and my grandfather, but to me that's exactly what they were. It was the same as hearing stories I might otherwise read in a newspaper about some woman I never really knew. Though my father would bring me with him when he put flowers on her grave, I never had any feelings associated with her. I felt only for the people she'd left behind. No one in my family or my circle of friends had ever had to confront something like this. Jamie was 17, a child on the verge of womanhood, dying and still very much alive at the same time. I was afraid, more afraid than I'd ever been, not only for her, but for me as well.
I lived in fear of doing something wrong, of doing something that would offend her. Was it okay to ever get angry in her presence? Was it okay to talk about the future anymore? My fear made talking to her difficult, though she was patient with me. My fear, however, made me realize something else, something that made it all worse. I realized I'd never even known her when she'd been healthy. I had started to spend time with her only a few months earlier, and I'd been in love with her for only 18 days. Those 18 days seemed like my entire life, but now when I looked at her, all I could do was wonder how many more days there would be. On Monday, she didn't show up for school, and I somehow knew that she'd never walk the hallways again. I'd never see her reading the Bible off by herself at lunch. I'd never see her brown cardigan moving through the crowd as she made her way to her next class. She was finished with school forever. She would never receive her diploma. I couldn't concentrate on anything while I sat in class that first day back, listening as teacher after teacher told us what most of us had already heard. The responses were similar to those in church on Sunday. Girls cried, boys hung their heads, people told stories about her as if she were already gone. What can we do? They wondered aloud. And people looked to me for answers. I don't know, was all I could say. I left school early and went to Jamie's, blowing off my classes after lunch. When I knocked at the door, Jamie answered it the way she always did, cheerfully and without, it seemed, a care in the world. "Hello, Landon," she said. "This is a surprise." When she leaned in to kiss me, I kissed her back, though the whole thing made me want to cry. "My father isn't home right now, but if you'd like to sit on the porch, we can." "How can you do this?" I asked suddenly. "How can you pretend that nothing is wrong?" "I'm not pretending that nothing is wrong, Landon. Let me get my coat, and we'll sit outside and talk, okay?" She smiled at me, waiting for an answer, and I finally nodded, my lips pressed together. She reached out and patted my arm. "I'll be right back," she said. I walked to the chair and sat down, Jamie emerging a moment later. She wore a heavy coat, gloves, and a hat to keep her warm. The nor'easter had passed, and the day wasn't nearly as cold as it had been over the weekend. Still, though, it was too much for her. "You weren't in school today," I said. She looked down and nodded. "I know. Are you ever going to come back?" Even though I already knew the answer, I needed to hear it from her. "No," she said softly, "I'm not." "Why, are you that sick already?" I started to tear up, and she reached out and took my hand. "No. Today I feel pretty good, actually. It's just that I want to be home in the mornings before my father has to go to the office. I want to spend as much time with him as I can." "Before I die," she meant to say, but didn't. I felt nauseated and couldn't respond. "When the doctors first told us," she went on, "they said that I should try to lead as normal a life as possible for as long as I could. They said it would help me keep my strength up." "There's nothing normal about this," I said bitterly. "I know." "Aren't you frightened?" Somehow I expected her to say no, to say something wise like a grown-up would, or to explain to me that we can't presume to understand the Lord's plan. She looked away. "Yes," she finally said. "I'm frightened all the time." "Then why don't you act like it?" "I do. I just do it in private." "Because you don't trust me?" "No," she said. "Because I know you're frightened too." I began to pray for a miracle. They supposedly happen all the time, and I'd read about them in newspapers. People regaining use of their limbs after being told they'd never walk again, or somehow surviving a terrible accident when all hope was lost. Every now and then a traveling preacher's tent would be set up outside of Beaufort, and people would go there to watch as people were healed. I'd been to a couple, and though I assumed that most of the healing was no more than a slick magic show, since I never recognized the people who were healed, there were occasionally things that even I couldn't explain.
Old Man Sweeney, the baker here in town, had been in the Great War, fighting with an artillery unit behind the trenches, and months of shelling the enemy had left him deaf in one ear. It wasn't an act. He really couldn't hear a single thing, and there'd been times when we were kids that we'd been able to sneak off with a cinnamon roll because of it. But the preacher started praying feverishly and finally laid his hand upon the side of Sweeney's head. Sweeney screamed out loud, making people practically jump out of their seats. He had a terrified look on his face as if the guy had touched him with a white-hot poker, but then he shook his head and looked around, uttering the words, "I can hear again." Even he couldn't believe it. "The Lord," the preacher had said as Sweeney made his way back to his seat, "can do anything. The Lord listens to our prayer." So that night, I opened the Bible that Jamie had given me for Christmas and began to read. Now, I'd heard all about Bible in Sunday school or at church, but to be frank, I just remembered the highlights. The Lord sending the 7 plagues so the Israelites could leave Egypt, Jonah being swallowed by a whale, Jesus walking across the water, or raising Lazarus from the dead. There were other biggies, too. I knew that practically every chapter of the Bible has the Lord doing something spectacular, but I hadn't learned them all. As Christians, we leaned heavily on teachings of the New Testament, and I didn't know the first things about books like Joshua or Ruth or Joel. The first night I read through Genesis. The second night I read through Exodus. Leviticus was next, followed by Numbers and then Deuteronomy. The going got a little slow during certain parts, especially as all the laws were being explained. Yet I couldn't put it down. It was a compulsion that I didn't fully understand. It was late one night, and I was tired by the time I eventually reached Psalms, but somehow I knew this was what I was looking for. Everyone has heard the 23rd Psalm, which starts, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want," but I wanted to read the others, since none of them are supposed to be more important than the others. After an hour, I came across an underlined section that I assumed Jamie had noted because it meant something to her. This is what it said. "I cry to you, my Lord, my rock. Do not be deaf to me. For if you are silent, I shall go down to the pit like the rest. Hear my voice in petition as I cry to you for help, as I raise my hands, my Lord, toward your holy of holies." I closed the Bible with tears in my eyes, unable to finish the psalm. Somehow I knew she'd underlined it for me. "I don't know what to do," I said numbly, staring into the dim light of my bedroom lamp. My mom and I were sitting on my bed. It was coming up on the end of January, the most difficult month of my life, and I knew that in February things would only get worse. "I know this is hard for you," she murmured, "but there's nothing you can do." "I don't mean about Jamie being sick. I know there's nothing I can do about that. I mean about Jamie and me." My mother looked at me sympathetically. She was worried about Jamie, but she was also worried about me. I went on. "It's hard for me to talk to her. All I can do when I look at her is think about the day when I won't be able to. So I spend all my time at school thinking about her, wishing I could see her right then, but when I get to her house, I don't know what to say." "I don't know if there's anything you can say to make her feel better." "Then what should I do?" She looked at me sadly and put her arm around my shoulder. "You really love her, don't you?" she said. "With all my heart." She looked as sad as I'd ever seen her. "What's your heart telling you to do?" "I don't know." "Maybe," she said gently, "you're trying too hard to hear it." The next day, I was better with Jamie, though not much. Before I'd arrived, I'd told myself that I wouldn't say anything that might get her down, that I'd try to talk to her like I had before. And that's exactly how it went. I sat myself on her couch and told her about some of my friends and what they were doing. I caught her up on the success of the basketball team. I told her that I still hadn't heard from UNC, but that I was hopeful I'd know within the next few weeks. I told her I was looking forward to graduation. I spoke as though she'd be back to school the following week, and I knew I sounded nervous the entire time. Jamie smiled and nodded at the appropriate times, asking questions every now and then. But I think we both knew by the time I finished talking that it was the last time I would do it. It didn't feel right to either of us. My heart was telling me exactly the same thing. I turned to the Bible again in the hope that it would guide me. "How are you feeling?" I asked a couple of days later. By now, Jamie had lost more weight. Her skin was beginning to take on a slightly grayish tint, and the bones in her hands were starting to show through her skin. Again, I saw bruises. We were inside her house in the living room. The cold was too much for her to bear. Despite all this, she still looked beautiful. "I'm doing okay," she said, smiling valiantly. "The doctors have given me some medicine for the pain, and it seems to help a little." I'd been coming by every day. Time seemed to be slowing down and speeding up at exactly the same time. "Can I get anything for you?"
"No, thank you. I'm doing fine."
I looked around the room, then back at her. "I've been reading the Bible," I finally said.
"You have?"
Her face lit up, reminding me of the angel I'd seen in the play. I couldn't believe that only 6 weeks had gone by. "I wanted you to know."
"I'm glad you told me."
"I read the book of Job last night," I said, "where God stuck it to Job to test his faith." She smiled and reached out to pat my arm, her hand soft on my skin. It felt nice.
"You should read something else. That's not about God in one of his better moments."
"Why would he have done that to him?"
"I don't know," she said.
"Do you ever feel like Job?" She smiled, a little twinkle in her eyes.
"Sometimes."
"But you haven't lost your faith?"
"No."
I knew she hadn't, but I think I was losing mine. "Is it because you think you might get better?"
"No," she said. "It's because it's the only thing I have left."
After that, we started reading the Bible together. It somehow seemed like the right thing to do, but my heart was nonetheless telling me that there still might be something more. At night, I lay awake, wondering about it. Reading the Bible gave us something to focus on, and all of a sudden everything started to get better between us. Maybe because I wasn't as worried about doing something to offend her. What could be more right than reading the Bible? Though I didn't know nearly as much as she did about it, I think she appreciated the gesture, and occasionally when we read, she'd put her hand on my knee and simply listen as my voice filled the room. Other times I'd be sitting beside her on the couch, looking at the Bible and watching Jamie out of the corner of my eye at the same time, and we'd come across a passage or a psalm, maybe even a proverb, and I'd ask her what she thought about it. She always had an answer, and I'd nod, thinking about it. Sometimes she asked me what I thought, and I did my best, too, though there were moments when I was bluffing, and I was sure that she could tell.
"Is that what it really means to you?"
she'd ask, and I'd rub my chin and think about it before trying again. Sometimes, though, it was her fault when I couldn't concentrate, what with that hand on my knee and all. One Friday night, I brought her over for dinner at my house. My mom joined us for the main course, then left the table and sat in the den so that we could be alone. It was nice there, sitting with Jamie, and I knew she felt the same way. She hadn't been leaving her house much, and this was a good change for her. Since she'd told me about her illness, Jamie had stopped wearing her hair in a bun, and it was still as stunning as it had been the first time I'd seen her wear it down. She was looking at the china cabinet, my mom had one of those cabinets with the lights inside, when I reached across the table and took her hand. "Thank you for coming over tonight," I said. She turned her attention back to me.
"Thanks for inviting me."
I paused. "How's your father holding up?" Jamie sighed.
"Not too well. I worry about him a lot."
"He loves you dearly, you know."
"I know."
"So do I," I said. And when I did, she looked away. Hearing me say this seemed to frighten her again.
Will you keep coming over to my house? She asked. Even later, you know, when...
I squeezed her hand. Not hard, but enough to let her know that I meant what I said. As long as you want me to come, I'll be there.
We don't have to read the Bible anymore if you don't want to.
Yes, I said softly, I think we do. She smiled.
You're a good friend, Landon. I don't know what I'd do without you.
She squeezed my hand, returning the favor. Sitting across from me, she looked radiant. I love you, Jamie, I said again. But this time she wasn't frightened. Instead, our eyes met across the table, and I watched as hers began to shine. She sighed and looked away, running her hand through her hair, then turned to me again. I kissed her hand, smiling in return.
I love you too, she finally whispered.
They were the words I'd been praying to hear. I don't know if Jamie told Hegbert about her feelings for me, but I somehow doubted it because his routine hadn't changed at all. It was his habit to leave the house whenever I came over after school, and this continued. I would knock at the door and listen as Hegbert explained to Jamie that he would be leaving and would be back in a couple of hours. Okay, Daddy, I always heard her say. Then I would wait for Hegbert to open the door. Once he let me in, he would open the hallway closet and silently pull out his coat and hat, buttoning the coat up all the way before he left the house. His coat was old-fashioned, black, and long like a trench coat without zippers, the kind that was fashionable earlier this century. He seldom spoke directly to me, even after he learned that Jamie and I had begun to read the Bible together. Though he still didn't like me in the house if he wasn't there, he nonetheless allowed me to come in. I knew that part of the reason had to do with the fact that he didn't want Jamie to get chilled by sitting on the porch, and the only other alternative was to wait at the house while I was there. But I think Hegbert needed some time alone, too, and that was the real reason for the change. He didn't talk to me about the rules of the house. I could see them in his eyes the first time he'd said I could stay. I was allowed to stay in the living room. That was all. Jamie was still moving around fairly well, though the winter was miserable. A cold streak blew in during the last part of January that lasted 9 days, followed by 3 straight days of drenching rain. Jamie had no interest in leaving the house in such weather, though after Hegbert had gone, she and I might stand on the porch for just a couple of minutes to breathe the fresh sea air. Whenever we did this, I found myself worrying about her. While we read the Bible, people would knock at the door at least 3 times every day. People were always dropping by, some with food, others just to say hello. Even Eric and Margaret came over, and though Jamie wasn't allowed to let them in, she did so anyway, and we sat in the living room and talked a little, both of them unable to meet her gaze. They were both nervous, and it took them a couple of minutes to finally get to the point. Eric had come to apologize, he said. And he said that he couldn't imagine why all this had happened to her, of all people. He also had something for her, and he set an envelope on the table, his hand shaking. His voice was choked up as he spoke, the words ringing with the most heartfelt emotion I'd ever heard him express.
"You've got the biggest heart of anyone I've ever met," he said to Jamie, his voice cracking. "And even though I took it for granted and wasn't always nice to you, I wanted to let you know how I feel. I've never been more sorry about anything in my life."
He paused and swiped at the corner of his eye.
"You're the best person I'll probably ever know."
As he was fighting back his tears and sniffling, Margaret had already given in to hers and sat weeping on the couch, unable to speak. When Eric had finished, Jamie wiped tears from her cheeks, stood slowly and smiled, opening her arms in what could only be called a gesture of forgiveness. Eric went to her willingly, finally beginning to cry openly as she gently caressed his hair, murmuring to him. The two of them held each other for a long time as Eric sobbed until he was too exhausted to cry anymore. Then it was Margaret's turn, and she and Jamie did exactly the same thing. When Eric and Margaret were ready to leave, they pulled on their jackets and looked at Jamie one more time, as if to remember her forever. I had no doubt that they wanted to think of her as she looked right then. In my mind, she was beautiful, and I know they felt the same way. "Hang in there," Eric said on his way out the door.